Welcome to At The Controls Extra with Mark Gallagher. And if you want to know, Jonathan Ledyard is broadcasting to the BBC today, which is why you're listening to me and not the two of us. But frankly, I'm quite pleased because it's quite appropriate. He's doing some BBC work this afternoon since I first met him when he was commentating on Formula One for BBC Five Live way back in the 1990s, which is much longer ago than any either of us really care to think about. So anyway, following that great podcast with James Allison from Mercedes F1 and author Callum Douglas discussing his new book, The Secret Horsepower Race, available from mortonsbooks.co.uk. Don't forget that. It is available from Amazon, but we don't want to mention that too much because Callum will earn a lot more from mortonsbooks.co.uk in return for his 6 years of hard work. So anyway, we thought it would be good to have a proper catch-up with Chris Papianu, because yes, he was part of the main podcast, but you know, inevitably we all ended up talking about Formula One, and I really wanted to have a chat with Chris about what he does and his career and some further insights. Now, before I go any further, let's get something straight, because us non-military types tend to often get titles and roles mixed up. Chris is the commanding officer of strike at the US Navy. Now, that makes him responsible for training, tactics development, and the acquisition of combat capabilities to support global warfare operations across all types of aircraft within the United States Navy. Yes, that's right. All types of aircraft within the United States Navy. Pretty big job. In his spare time, apparently he has some, Chris also performs executive coaching, leadership development, team cohesion and performance management, and combat training for the deployment of US Navy aircrew. When I say in his spare time, this is actually also part of his job. I won't even go on to mention the fact that he spent nearly 2 years working on the United States space program. That's like a sideshow, can you believe? Anyway, I also don't think I've mentioned the fact that he has flown over 3,700 hours in high-performance fighter aircraft. Extraordinary. I should also mention, just ahead of this conversation, that I caught up with Chris on a Saturday morning at home in Nevada. That's his home in Nevada. And if you hear his family in the background, just enjoy it, because it's not often you get to chat with someone like Chris on his day off, never mind being invited quite literally into his family home with all of the wonderful noise that our great kids can make in the background. So enjoy the conversation. We're going to start with a very simple question. Tell us a little bit about your background and how you ended up deciding to have a career in flying in the Navy.
Well, that's actually an interesting story. So I had no connections to the military other than my uncle was a Marine Corps infantryman back in the Korean War era, but that was about it. I grew up actually, my father was a race car driver. He largely had stopped racing when I was young, but we were always around the racetracks when I was a kid. So, you know, I had a lot of interest in race cars back then.
What did he race?
So he was a drag racer in Southern California. And this was back in the era when, you know, they were largely very innovative and the rules weren't quite there. He actually started drag racing at the age of 13. So well before Wow. He actually had a driver's license. But he did it professionally for a number of years. He was also involved with some land speed records and kind of car development with that piece as well out in the desert.
So he was out in the desert doing crazy speeds. Oh, yeah. Was he driving himself?
Yep. And he raced against some of the, you know, some of the greats back then, Don Prudhomme and so forth, and those guys. It was a very big scene back in the 50s and early 60s in Southern California. And so he did that. And ultimately, he had a big accident. He actually double flipped the car going down the track at about I think it was around 200 miles an hour back then, which back then was obviously big speeds. And
you're lucky to be here. Yeah, you're lucky to be here.
Yeah, exactly. And so my mom, exactly what she thought as well. She looked at him afterwards and she looked at the car, which the joke was minus the engine, they actually put the car, the remainder of the car in a 55-gallon drum and walked away. That's how bad the wreck was. And she looked at him and said, yeah, you're done. You know, you can be involved with racing, but your driving days are done. So he stayed involved largely with racing. And so I grew up around the tracks as a kid. But it was actually in January of 86, I walked into class one day as a fifth grader. And we watched the news and it was the Challenger incident. And I had never heard of the space shuttle. I didn't know anything about it, but there was something about seeing the main engines light off, seeing the solid rocket boosters light off and seeing just that power of the shuttle lifting off of the launch pad that just absolutely enamored me. And certainly I recognize that this was an extraordinary tragedy. There is no doubt. But I was just so enamored by the space shuttle itself. And, you know, through some research afterwards and figuring out how do you go do that and what's the career path, and, you know, being a military fighter pilot is kind of the easy way to get there. And then later in the summer that year is when Top Gun came out. And I remember still to this day sitting in the movie theater and seeing jets fly left and right, right and left across the screen, and going, all right, I'm in. I'm done at this point. This is what I want to go do. And so that just started kind of a singular focus for the rest of my childhood to get there and get into this business.
It's extraordinary that you can think of that point in time, watching the Challenger incident and that kind of triggering your fascination with the technology. What was the point at which you then thought it's naval flying? And by the way, naval flying as opposed to Air Force flying.
Yeah.
Because there are lots of forks in the road, aren't there, during your career? So what led to those couple of forks for you?
I think that's something for every child that wants to be a fighter pilot. That's one of the biggest questions is, do I go fly for the Air Force? Do I go fly for the Navy? And I say this with the ultimate respect of Air Force fighter pilots. I mean, I've trained with them, I've flown with them, I fought with them, you know, in combat. They're absolutely fantastic. But as a child, I looked at it and said, okay, you know, there's obviously a clear difference here. You know, an Air Force fighter guy is going to land on a, 6,000 to 12,000 foot runway. And that's not that challenging. And you take a Navy fighter pilot and they're going to land on a carrier in the middle of the ocean that's bobbing up and down. And they're going to do that day, night, good weather, bad weather. It doesn't matter. That's incredible. And if I'm going to put in this effort and do this and put in all the hard work and the hours and so forth that are associated with doing it, then I want to be part of the best. And so that's when I chose the Navy.
So on an earlier episode of At the Controls, we had Mandy Hickson, and she was the Royal Air Force's second ever female tornado pilot. She flew tornadoes and has written an excellent book called An Officer, Not a Gentleman. And I, now that I follow her on social media, I see the rivalry between the Air Force and the Royal Navy. You know, that it's really amusing to see some of the things that she posts. Tell me a little bit about that rivalry. I mean, there must be a rivalry. How does that work? What's the pecking order? Do you look down on them or do they look down on you?
I think it depends on which side you ask. I think we both say we look down on each other. but there is certainly a rivalry, but it's a positive rivalry. You know, at the end of the day, we're all in it together and we're all just doing our best and trying to be as good as we can be in the airplane. But I will tell you a funny story. And this is absolutely 100% part of the rivalry, because I can say this publicly over this. There was a moment, maybe about 10 years ago. And I had a friend who I was on the Top Gun staff with that was doing a exchange tour with the Air Force flying F-22s. And at the time, the F-22 was fairly new, especially when we started talking about how we would integrate the F-22 into Navy fighter tactics and so forth. And so he and I were getting together and we were putting together these events where we could integrate the F-18 with the F-22. And I was in a fleet squadron, so we were actually going on the carrier for a couple weeks at a time and coming off. And we were able to put together this very large exercise with us flying off the boat and the Raptors coming out over the ocean from a land base and then integrating with each other tactically. Well, in order to do that, they had to put a F-22 pilot on the boat as kind of a liaison officer to help us sort of do some mission planning and make sure we were integrating right, and then be there for the debrief so we could make sure we captured all the right lessons. And so I'm getting this Air Force F-22 guy out, and I was thinking as he was on his way out, it's like, I've got to get this guy in the backseat of an F-18. I've got to get him a flight off the boat. You know, this is a golden opportunity for him. I need to do this for him. And so I get him on the schedule, and he's scheduled for a backseat F-18 ride during the day. And then a couple hours later, he was going to go on a backseat ride in an F-18 at night. So he goes off and does his day flight. I was flying as well. I come back and I catch up with him after his day flight, and walked up to him and was like, hey, man, how'd it go? What'd you think? And he goes, you know, it is hard to explain what the catch shot feels like and what the landing feels like. The only way I can explain it was just violent. It was extraordinarily violent. I was like, well, that's actually a pretty good way to put it. Wait till you see it at night. And he looks at me deadpan, straight in the eyes, and goes, no chance. There is no chance that I'm going to go do that at night.
I can get that. And, you know, Chris, you just reminded me of something. Tell me about that, because you and I had spoken earlier last week about the cat shots and, you know, taking off from the deck of a carrier. And during the podcast, you were talking about, with James Allison, we were talking about the 2-second pit stops that we do in Formula One. And I really wanted to interject and say, hang on a second. Can someone ask Chris what he does in 2 seconds? Because you take off and you take off in 2 seconds. You go from 0 to 165 miles an hour in 2 seconds. And as you said in the podcast, you're kind of a passenger at that point. You're in the hands of other people and the technology to get you off the deck. So one of the questions I had for you was, how soon after you take off that deck are you then in control? when does control come back into your hands?
Yeah, that's a valid question. It's a great question. We trim the airplane up such that it naturally wants to seek a lower speed coming off the boat. And what that does is it elevates the nose as soon as you come off the flight deck. But as soon as you come off, basically you're grabbing the stick. And that's something actually most people don't know, is when we're going down the cat shot, I'm not holding on to the stick. The only thing I'm holding on to with my hand is the throttle. And that's just to make sure that the forces don't bring the throttle back, because obviously that would be bad. So I've got, you know, my arm locked on the throttle, my elbow locked there. And then I've got my hand on what we call a towel rack, which is just on the canopy bow. So we're not even holding the stick as we go down. But as soon as you come off the flight deck, your hand immediately comes down, grabs the stick, and you're flying away. So it happens pretty quick that you regain control and take a kind of sigh of relief once you've got the airspeed, you know, you need.
So last night I had a call from a longstanding friend of mine, and he was saying, what are you doing tomorrow? And I said, well, I'm kind of having an average Saturday, including I'm talking to Chris, who's a commanding officer of Strike. And he was like, yeah, you know, that's cool. He said, tell me some interesting facts about that. And I was very struck when I was researching the podcast about the fact that when you land on the deck of a carrier, you land on full throttle, because you're essentially, yes, you're getting ready to. And so that came as a complete surprise to this pal of mine. Just talk us through the landing, and essentially you're preparing. I mean, you want it to go perfectly, but you're also preparing for the eventuality that it doesn't go according to plan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You know, the landing itself is actually really interesting. There's a lot of dynamics at play, just from 3/4 of a mile, which is, you know, behind the boat, which is where we consider the landing to start. And it takes about, on average, between 15 and 19 seconds to travel from 3/4 of a mile behind the boat to actually touching down in the wires. And you're dealing with a lot in that time frame. You know, the natural kind of biggest piece of that is maintaining the right glide slope, or, you know, descent angle as you come down to land. Cause, you know, one of the most important things is that you clear the back end of the boat and you don't hit it with the airplane. And so the glide slope itself is designed to get your hook point just over 14 feet. It's like 14 and a few inches above the ramp of the boat as you pass over it. So maintaining that glide slope is 100% the most thing that you're focused on. And then, as we talked about during the podcast, your landing area is actually angled from about 9 to 11 degrees, depending on the ship, to the left. So the landing area itself, as the boat moves through the water, is actually moving from left to right. And you don't have much slop. You have a couple feet on either side before you start hitting airplanes. And so certainly, you know, maintaining center line is an important critical piece as well. And so as you're doing that, you have a lot of weird wind effects. You get this clear air that comes off the aircraft carrier that doesn't run into anything. It just kind of rides along the flight deck that serves as sort of a lifty for you right after the start of the pass. And so you go through this really clean air, and you're having to throttle back a little bit to keep the airplane on glide slope and sort of bring the nose down. And then right after that, you get the burble there, which is all the air that came over the flight deck and ran into people, airplanes, the structure, and everything else. So you go from this, I've got too much clean air, to now I don't have enough clean air. So now you're powering up and bringing the nose up, try to maintain that glide slope. And then right about the time you're crossing the ramp is sort of when you get back into clean air again. And then, so the whole time you're solely focused on your glide slope, maintaining center line. And then as soon as the airplane touches down, it is straight to full power, just in case you skip the wires. Maybe you just passed over the wires, you got a little too high, or whatever the case may be. And you just have to be ready to go around. Now, all of that is if it's a perfectly clear blue sky day, calm sea states and so forth. You take that into, you know, what I would consider kind of the most routine worst case scenario, which is at night you've got heavy sea states, and now you have a stern of the ship that is moving, no kidding, plus or minus 10 feet. So a total of 20 feet of swing. And now you're really relying on the people that are watching the airplane, what we call the Atlantic signal officers. They're there to make sure you maintain glide slope and maintain center line. And you're really relying on their calls to get you over the ramp of the boat, no matter where it's at in its swing. And so when we get pitching decks, you are 100% reliant on that landing signal officer to get you over the flight deck and make sure you don't run into the back of the boat. And that's where things really get dynamic.
Does your wife realize what a multitasking husband she has?
No, and that's a good thing because it keeps the to-do list at home very short.
It's fascinating hearing you talking about turbulence in clear air, because, of course, that's something we talk about in Formula One all the time. And I mean, it's self-evident. It's, the world of aerospace engineering and aerodynamics in Formula One, it arrived in our sport in the 1970s and, came from the world of aviation. But getting a little bit of turbulence, when you're behind Lewis Hamilton trying to catch up with him, and getting a little bit of turbulence when you've got the back of USS Nimitz heaving out of the ocean in front of you, it's pretty stressful. And I was really interested to hear you say during the podcast that even though you've landed on a carrier 900 times, it's never something that you're complacent about. It's never something that's straightforward. It requires a lot of focus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And actually, I was a little reluctant afterwards, or disappointed rather in myself that I didn't bring this up during the podcast, but one of the things that the Navy does, and this is really, I thought, a genius element of what we do, is every time you land at the boat, it's graded by the landing signal officers. In typical naval aviation humor, if you fly basically what would amount to a perfect pass, which is not easy to do, it's called a fair pass. And that's on a grading scale about a 4.0. If you have some kind of major deviation of glide slope or lineup, and you work too quick to fix it, they'll downgrade that to a fair pass. I'm sorry, it's an okay pass if it was a 4.0. It's a fair pass if you had a major deviation. And that's a 3.0 on the grading scale. And then you can have a bolter, which is when the hook point misses all the wires, whether it skips them all or you just overflew all the wires. That's a 2.0. Then you can have a no grade, which is if you hit the first wire from the perspective of behind the boat. So the very first wire you pass, if you hit that one, that means you got a little too low crossing the ramp, and that's a no grade, which is a 1.0. And then you can get a cut pass, which is you did something extraordinarily dangerous. And to your point earlier about going to throttles, a max power on the touchdown, that would be something, if you didn't do that, that they would consider a cut pass. And that's a 0 grade, obviously. So we have this grading scale, and every time you land behind the boat, it's graded. And of course, we're a type A personalities. We're very competitive. And so we're going to keep track of everybody's grades, and we're going to do it on a daily basis, and we're going to rank each other. And the ranking is going to go up every single day in the squadron ready rooms and so forth. And we have what we call line periods, which is just a period of the deployment, kind of like a race season, where they'll tally up all the grades for all the pilots on the aircraft carrier, and then the top 10 get awards and so forth. And so that concept of grading every single pass and our type A, mixing that with our type A personalities, kind of also just ensures that you're focused every time. And when you get to a point where you're running for those top 10 spots within the air wing, right at the end of a line period, things get really, really tense. In fact, I had probably one of my best competitions was with my roommate, who was also a prior Top Gun instructor at the time. And he and I were vying for the number one, number two spot across the air wing. And it was going back and forth depending on the day and the landings. And you'll appreciate this, Mark. We somehow, and I don't know how it started, but we got ourselves into this mindset of taking a Red Bull with us on every single flight. And at the time, we were supporting combat operations. So our flights were between 7 and 8 hours long. So you would be in the jet with this, if you include the startup, which is about 45 minutes, you're in the jet for 8 to 9 hours sitting in the seat by the time that you come back down and actually land. And so we got so competitive with each other that we were looking just for that little subtle edge right at the end of the flight. And so we actually timed it down to the minute of when we would actually drink the Red Bull prior to landing to make sure that we were, our brain was sparked back up and we were ready to go to try to fly the most perfect pass that we could. So
I don't know I don't know if Dietrich Mateschitz, the founder of Red Bull, is listening to the podcast, but that's probably one of the less expected uses of Red Bull.
Exactly.
And he would appreciate that enormously. Let's just talk about another topic, which we kind of skipped over in the podcast. And I was trying to be funny, but I was making the point that you can't really change sides when you fly for the US military. But you quite rightly pointed out that you change squadrons. And a couple of things about that was, so I've noticed that every squadron has its name. You know, you've got you joined the Flying Eagles, and then there was the Top Hatters, and then there were the Kestrels and the Argonauts. Talk to us a little bit about that further. Just, you know, a couple of minutes on, you know, the squadrons have their own names, and clearly they do have their own identity. And I presume that identity comes with some heritage and background. And so that really colors the culture of each squadron.
Absolutely. I would say it's very similar to different racing teams. You know, each team has its own current culture. Each team has its own heritage. And it's very similar going into a squadron. And it's surprising, but the cultures from squadron to squadron can be extraordinarily different. You know, the Top Hatters is a great example. You talk about heritage. They're the oldest continuous active duty flying squadron in naval aviation. Their heritage goes back to the early 1900s. And that history really carried the squadron, and it really defined the culture. And we had a great culture, and they still do in that squadron. It was very much blue collar focused. You know, we were competitive, you know, but we were there to do our job, and we were there to make sure everybody else was doing their job as best they could within the squadron. It didn't matter if you were a pilot flying one of the airplanes, or you were the most junior maintainer working on the airplanes. We just had this really blue collar, humble focused culture that led to just years of success with that squadron. And then I was in other squadrons where you had, you know, not as strong of a culture, and you mix that with some bad leadership in that squadron, and the squadron dynamic was just horrible. And it did not enable what we were there to do, which at the end of the day is really power projection and winning in combat. Those cultures just didn't allow for that to happen. So I would say it's very similar to what you've probably seen in Formula One.
Yeah, and no question about that. I think a huge believer in the fact that all the Formula One teams have, actually, when you look at it, they have great facilities and budgets. I mean, yes, you might only have $100 million as opposed to $200 million or something, but all Formula One teams have lots of things going for them. The thing that really makes a difference is the leadership, the culture. And there's no question, you know, with having James Allison on the podcast with you, Chris, again, it's driven home the fact that Mercedes is a pretty special team in terms of how they interact, how they work together, the alignment that they have, and the focus that they bring to their task every day. And I think, again, James made a pretty good point about what a great leader Toto Wolff has. Now, let's just talk about your leadership a little bit further, because I'm going to read something, not ideal on a podcast to do some reading, but I need to read this because it sums up very well you, Chris. As commanding officer, at one point you were responsible for the training, safety, and welfare of 220 officers and sailors. This is on the USS Nimitz, as well as maintenance and operation of 12 $87 million FA-18A Super Hornets, plus all the supporting equipment and weapons, about $1.2 billion in assets.
Yeah.
Chris, this is big stuff. I mean, and for you as a pilot, you know, you've been elevated into a position where you've got this large group of people, all this technology, and the maintenance and the supply chain and all of the operations around that, a pretty profound and demanding requirement on you. Just so that transition from being a pilot to having all of that underneath you, yeah, must have been quite a step.
Absolutely. There's a lot of responsibility and the way the Navy treats commanding officers, which is hugely powerful to our capability with the Navy, is command is ultimate. It's your squadron. It's your command. You have ultimate responsibility, ultimate authority. And so that brings with it a lot of pressure as well. But, you know, it's like any organization. You can boil leadership down to just a few, in reality, simple rules. You know, first and foremost, and you know, I mentor today to still, I mentor a lot of senior officers in the Navy on jobs, you know, they're getting ready to do jobs that I've already done. And one of the things I pass on to them is what I call rule number one. And I mentioned this during the podcast, but I refer to it as rule number one or the golden rule of leadership. And oh, by the way, there's only one rule of leadership, which is it's never about you. It's always about the people and creating an environment where you can enable those people to perform at their best. And so you've got to come into these things with the right leadership. And I've seen a lot of leaders that didn't perform as well as they could have, as well as they were talented enough to be able to do, because they started to make it about themselves to some degree. And so, you know, you have to go into it with the right leadership mindset. And then you have to have the right vision. And the vision, there's no one right answer for a vision. It really depends on what's the environment that your organization, or in this case, squadron, is going to go operate in. What are the challenges that are associated with that environment, and how are you going to overcome that environment, or how does the organization need to overcome that environment in order to win at the end of the day? And I would, you know, and again, I'd largely equate it to a racing team, right? You know, their job and their singular focus is to win. That's our job as well. Our singular focus is when the phone call comes to go down range, we're there to go win at the end of the day. And so you have to kind of create this culture that enables that. And then once you've got that culture, and this is why it was so great to talk with James and kind of compare the cultures between Mercedes as well as specifically Top Gun, is once you've got that sort of positive leadership and role model at the top, and you've got this culture that's going to enable their people to do their best and perform their best, now you can go after those incremental gains and so forth. So it's there is certain elements that you have to have with the culture. You know, you have to have high standards, and you have to have people that are passionate enough to try to reach those standards. And you can hold those high standards as long as you're positive about getting people to them. You've got to have confidence and humility, and you've got to know when those are key. You know, in a Formula One race, I would assume, you know, once you get to the race and the lights go out, you've got to have, everybody's got to be confident in their decision making. The driver's got to be confident in his ability to drive. We talked a little bit about that with flying. It's once we start flight ops on an aircraft carrier, it doesn't matter if it's my most junior maintainer or me in the jet, I've got to be confident that the team's ready to go, and we're each individually confident what we can do. And then you have to have that trust and mutual respect from the most junior folks to the most senior folks. You know, one of the things I did as CO was, I said it multiple times throughout my time, is I don't care if it's me or if it's our brand new 18-year-old sailor in the squadron that's just learning how to be in the Navy, you will treat both of us with the same level of respect, and everybody in between as well. And then as James and I talked about quite a bit, you have to have that open and honest and sort of safe communication. So I know that's a long answer, Mark, but you know, you've got to build sort of that box with the leadership and the culture and the incremental gains to really be successful as an organization.
So a couple of other things, Chris, that I wanted to ask you about. One is that period when you were commanding officer of Top Gun. I don't think people realize just how elite Top Gun is. Mm-hmm. Just give us again, for the layman listener, an insight into the filtering process just to get into Top Gun, never mind to progress through it.
Yeah, it is a very, very selective process. You apply to the course. It's no longer like it was sort of portrayed in the first Top Gun movie where, you know, you go through the course and then they decide to keep you or not. You really sort of apply to the course. And then if you want to be a Top Gun instructor, you also apply to be a Top Gun instructor and go through what we call a rush process effectively. You know, we're looking at the really top, I'd say 1-5% of Navy fighter pilots is kind of our pool that we're pulling from. And we grade it kind of as I alluded to in the podcast with James. We're looking at really three things. We're looking at how passionate are they about what we're here to do, and how passionate are they about being good in the airplane and teaching others to be good in the airplane. What's their personality like, and then ultimately their talent level in the airplane. And as we look at those, as I mentioned before, we're not looking for somebody that's a rock star in the airplane. I cannot tell you over the years how many people Top Gun has turned down that were absolutely phenomenal in the airplane. They just didn't have the right personality, and that will take them out of the fight immediately. And so we're kind of looking for those traits, and then we put them through the course. And the course today is 13 weeks long. It's 12 weeks now long. And they're in a pressure cooker for all 12 weeks. There is no social life. There is no life outside of Top Gun. As they're going through the course, they are studying or briefing and debriefing or flying constantly. And so we use the course to kind of teach them to be instructors and learn how to teach other people. And then we use the course to elevate their talent level significantly from the start of the course to the end of the course. So it's really what kind of makes it special is you're really dealing with that sort of, like I said, top 1% of Top Gun folks.
Chris, one of the big topics in Formula One these days, apart from what fuels our cars will be running on in the years ahead, is why don't we have women racing in Formula One cars? And as you may know, there's been a new championship, the W Series for women, a feeder category. My good friend David Coulthard is the chairman of the W Series. So there is a big effort on to try and fill the pipeline of talent for women to race in Formula One, and we're hoping to see that very soon. What's your experience of women in the U.S. Naval Aviation arena? And just talk to us about the diversity, because that's clearly probably changed quite a lot during the course of your career.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it has changed quite a bit. When I first joined the Navy, there were a small handful of female fighter pilots, and they were right on the edge of being allowed to fly in actually deploying squadrons that are going to go into combat. And so it was largely a new thing when I first joined. And where we're at today is in a great spot where it doesn't matter what your background is. It doesn't matter what your gender is. If you show the passion and the work ethic and, to be here and do this business, you're in. And even when you take that forward to Top Gun class selections, I mean, we have females come through, you know, several per year through the Top Gun course. You know, that's nothing new for us. We have female Top Gun instructors, and we've had them throughout the history of the organization. You know, we don't really kind of restrict who comes in. In fact, I think, you know, a perception I've had over the years of being involved with Top Gun is that, you know, Top Gun instructors are these, you know, people that come from rich backgrounds, or they were born with silver spoons in their mouth. And, you know, there were in our version of that would be, you know, your father was an admiral in the Navy, and, you know, because he was an admiral, he's been able to smooth over your career and get you to the good places. And that's really not true. I mean, we have people with all kinds of backgrounds. And again, genders doesn't matter. And as far as females performing in fighters, I will tell you that we had a female student go through. Again, it's consistent, but we had one go through, gosh, about a year and a half ago now, and I would put her squarely in the top five graduates I've ever seen come out of Top Gun, if not the number one graduate. I mean, she just absolutely crushed the course. She was a phenomenal instructor and just extraordinarily talented in the airplane.
So whenever you watch Formula One, and you know you're passionate about Formula One as a sport, what would your message be to the sport of Formula One? You know, if you had about women coming into Formula One in terms of, because believe it or not, Chris, there are still people I know from social media, there's still people who say, well, women wouldn't be able to do it in Formula One for physical reasons or whatever. You know, what would your message be about that?
I would say don't underestimate what a woman can do. And it doesn't matter what the medium is. It doesn't matter what the profession is. It sounds antiquated, but, you know, females doing these businesses are just as capable and just as good as any male that does this business. You know, it comes down to the personalities. And you see this, you know, we talked a little bit about Lewis Hamilton's personality and how he's able to stay on top. He's very passionate. He's a hard worker. He's disciplined. I've seen so many female fighter pilots that are the exact same way. You know, I'll tell you, from a tactics background and a Top Gun background, you know, in the Navy, we also have folks that are test pilot backgrounds. And, you know, typically your test pilot backgrounds, they're phenomenal aviators. They're very talented. They're very, very smart. But when it comes to tactics execution, typically they're not as good as those guys that are, you know, Top Gun graduates and so forth. And I had a department head in my squadron that I was CEO of that was a female. She was a test pilot background. She's actually trying to get into NASA right now. And she did phenomenal in tactics execution. I mean, she was just as good as some of my prior Top Gun instructors that were in the squadron. And, you know, for her to be able to do that with a strong test background and translate to being able to execute tactically in the airplane was tremendous. So my message would be, just like I said before, don't underestimate it. They are extraordinarily capable.
Well, that's great. And don't worry about the word antiquated in relation to thought processes, because I promise you in Formula One, there are a lot of antiquated still thought processes, which we need to get by, and we need more diversity, more nationalities. You know, it's still a very Eurocentric sport as well as a very male-dominated sport. A final question for you, Chris, before I let you go, and this is just a kind of one that came to mind when I was researching this. So I was reading about the USS Nimitz, and, you know, that's kind of your office where you were based, and, of course, you've been in other carriers as well. And again, just for folks listening, you know, that carrier it's 1,100 feet long. It's nuclear powered. I was so amused to read about its powertrain. I went straight to look at its power system, and I was amused to read that its range and its life cycle is actually listed as unlimited because it's a nuclear powered ship and 3,500 people working there. What's life like on board one of these amazing pieces of technology?
It's a lot of fun. You know, obviously the downside is you're away from your family, and you're away from your family for, you know, not days at a time, but months at a time. But, you know, with that being said, it's a lot of fun. There's, when you get the entire air wing on board the aircraft carrier, you're actually sitting at about 5,000 people total. You've got all the amenities you basically need. I mean, you've got galleys for the food, and you've got your workspace, you've got your ready room, which is largely kind of your social gathering space. There's plenty of workout facilities. I mean, you can largely live kind of a normal life. You're just, you know, out at sea. And there is some enjoyment in going out on an aircraft carrier, going out, doing flying and so forth. And you'll fly for a couple of weeks at a time, and then you'll pull into port somewhere. And then you know, get a week off in some foreign port, and then you have fun and you get back on the boat, you go out, you fly again, and then you pull into port a couple of weeks later. And being able to see the world is pretty cool, especially when you look at some of the junior enlisted that, you know, never left their hometown in some small town USA, and now they're out exploring the world at 18, 19 years old. It's pretty cool to see the reactions on their faces as they walk off the ship in some other country. There's a lot of enjoyment there. We're all there for a common goal, so there's a lot of common focus on the boat on day-to-day operations. Not to say that there are not hard times on a boat. It's kind of funny. It's the USS Nimitz, for example, is a ship. The folks that drive the ship don't like us to call it a boat, but it's just naval aviation humor. We call it the boat. We were in an operating environment in 2017, supporting combat operations, and the average temperature on the flight deck was just the outside air temperature was 140 degrees. And that was before the jet exhaust hit you. When the jet exhaust hit you, and it hit, you know, skin, it felt like somebody was taking a blowtorch to you. And to see, that was probably one of the most humbling moments I've ever had in this business, to see the sailors and the maintainers out on the flight deck working 8-hour shifts. Now, they were coming in and going out, and we made sure they had plenty of water and cool spaces and so forth. But to see them out there operating in that environment, getting the job done, doing it flawlessly and doing it safely was absolutely incredible. So in a large way, being out on those boats is very much a humbling experience as well, just to see the team execute.
Yeah, I think, and that certainly resonates with me when I look at the amazing job that the race teams do, very often working 16-hour days and in pretty tough conditions at times. Much better these days than perhaps it used to be in terms of the facilities. But Chris, really a delight to hear your insights. So much of a pleasure for Jonathan and I to have had you on the main podcast with James Allison, but really good of you to take your time out and give us this little bit of further insight, and we hope to speak to you again soon.
Yeah, my pleasure, Mark. It's always a pleasure to chat with you anytime.